Welcome to side two of the Sunday Morning Hangover. We're going to get a phone call from Leo DeLion, we hope. In the meantime, more Leo DeLion. This is a rare single on Oriole called The Blue Train. Hope you enjoy it.
Blue train, blue train, blue train. Oh, how did I get on the blue train?
Blue train.
I used to happy and gay.
So gay,
but I was untrue to my darling,
darling,
and this is the price I must pay. Oh, the blue train, the blue train, the blue train. It's special for lovers like me, who gamble with fire in the love game.
Love game.
And this is the sad penalty. Oh, the blue train, the blue train, the blue train. The whistle's beginning to blow. Yes, I was untrue, my darling,
darling,
conductor, I'm ready to go. Conductor, I'm ready to go. Conductor, I'm ready to go.
Blue train, blue train, blue train, blue train.
How about you? I like a Gershwin tune. How about you? I love a fireside when a storm is due. I like potato chips, moonlight, and motor trips. How about you? Oh, I'm mad about good books. Can't get my fill. And Bridget Bardot's looks crazy, give me a thrill. Holding hands in a movie show, just when the lights are low. May not be new, but I like it. How about you? I like the Yonkin tune. How about you? I like the Gershwin tune. How about you? I love a fireside when the storm is due. I like potato chips, moonlight, and motor trips. How about you? Oh, I'm mad about good books, can't get my fill. And Bridget Bardot's looks give me a thrill. Holding hands in a movie show just when the lights are low. May not be true, but I like it. How about? I like it. How about? I like it. How about you?
If you're beggar or king and your heart wants to sing, then you're rich in love. You cannot feel alone like a king on a throne when you're rich in love. Somewhere,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
there's a someone very lonely,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
who could be your one and only.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
She will want you if you care. Love is there, then you'll be free as air. If you're rich or you're poor, got someone you adore, then you're rich in love. You must never despair if there's
there's someone to share when you're rich in love. Somewhere,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
there's a someone very lonely,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
who could be your one and only.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
She will want you if you care. Love is there, then you'll be rich in love. Plum, 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 plum.
Hey Leo, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have the incredibly famous Leo D. Lyon on the phone. Where are you, Leo? North Hollywood?
North Hollywood, California.
Yes, and we've been playing all your stuff for about an hour. This has been a regular Leo D. Lyon Love Fest, and I really appreciate you coming on the air with us here on the Sunday
Morning
Hangover. Well,
I'm absolutely honored over the fact that somebody could play an hour's worth of my stuff on the air.
Oh, I haven't played everything yet either. I just want to let you know some of the things that I've been playing. I played Rich in Love, which was on that single on Oriole out of England. I played Mule Train. I played How About You. I played...
Wait a minute. You just stunned me with another disc. You had Rich in Love?
Yes, yes. And
Boy, you must have had... I can't imagine how you dug that up.
Oh, yes, and that's the B-side of... the B-side is Mule Train, or was Blue Train... Was Blue Train the A-side?
You know, I think Blue Train was the A-side, but I'm not really sure at this point. That was done in 1960, I believe.
Yeah, yeah. You had a string of really great records in the 50s and 60s, and I was wondering, because I think the last one I played earlier in the show, a track called, it was called The Happy Sounds of Paris, which is off a soundtrack of The Man Called Flintstone.
That's correct. I was doing quite a bit of stuff with Hanna-Barbera at that time.
Right, and I'm wondering how much more of that is out there. Do you think there's a lot more of that out there?
Well, no, that was the only one. There's a whole soundtrack LP of that particular production, that film. It was an animated film.
Right.
A little takeoff on James Bond and all that kind of stuff.
Right, right.
But, I might tell you a very funny story, if I may.
Oh, yes.
How I got that gig.
We have a lot of time, Leo.
Okay.
We're going to be on for like another 40 minutes.
All right. Okay, then I'll talk fast. Okay. Now, this is a riot.
Okay. Keep it clean now.
They were auditioning. Oh, yeah, no, this is clean, and it's very showbiz. It's funny. They were looking for someone to sing a song that was going to be featured in that animated feature called Gay Paris or whatever.
Yeah, The Man Called Flintstone.
And they wanted somebody to sing with a nice French accent. So about eight guys were called to audition for that. And then it boiled down to two guys.
Right.
Me and a guy named Robert Clary.
Oh, I know who that is.
Does that ring a bell with
you?
Yes,
yes, the guy from Hogan's Heroes, right?
That's right. He was the Frenchman. And he was a real Frenchman.
Right.
And I knew Robert Clary from years before because he was in a Broadway musical, big one, and I can't think of the name, where he had a big hit song from. It wasn't a hit with the public, but it was a standing ovation kind of song in the film, in the Broadway show, and it was I'm in Love with Miss Logan. Anyway, so here is Charlie, and I knew him because we worked nightclubs together, we worked the Blue Angel together. He had a wonderful act. He was a singer, and
right.
He came to this country in 1950, 50. I think he was about 22 years old at the time. And, okay, so now it's down to me and him. So when I saw him, I said to myself, oh, this is ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, they want a guy singing with a French accent.
Yeah.
I said, there's the guy, you know. And I almost was going to turn around and say, oh, and I was going to, like, just cut out. But I figured, oh, the heck with it. I hung around. So he goes in, and he auditions. And what the way they audition is they sing with a background track.
Right.
You see? And they have to be taught the song. I can sight sing because being a musician, so I didn't have to be taught the song.
Yeah.
I just picked up the sheet and read it off. Now, I figured, well, okay, I'll go in, I'll do it. But psychologically, I knew that Joe Barbera always liked to go with exaggerated sounds, imitating. So, Robert Clary, his accent was very real. His English was excellent, but the accent was nice, and he sang it like a Frenchman, but very moderately.
Right.
When I sang it, I chewed it out like I was Maurice Chevalier underwater. I exaggerated. No, you took taxi cab. I really chewed it out. I got the gig.
Well, that's the thing. You put that Leo DeLion spin on it.
I exaggerated because I knew that that's what Joe Barbera would like.
Well, that's a great story about how you beat out him for the audition. So, Leo, can we go back a ways? I want to go back way a ways. Let's talk about where you grew up and where you were born. Can you tell us a little?
I was born in Paterson, New Jersey.
Paterson. I got a friend from Paterson. All right.
Yep. I was born there April 26th, 1925. And went to school number 6, which was a lovely grammar school. And in 1936, we moved to Brooklyn, New York.
Oh, you moved up.
So at age 11, and from then on, I was a New Yorker.
Right, right. And I understand you did some service, and I wanted to thank you for your submarine service in World War II.
Yeah. Well, I didn't do any of the real dramatic heroic type of work.
Right.
I did mostly, I was with a submarine, I was part of a squadron that did mostly training and teaching.
Right.
Although we had some interesting incidents, I used to do the wildest disc jockey show in the world. I used to, you remember during World War II, they used to have V-discs.
Right.
V-discs were these big 12-inch and even larger.
I remember seeing some of these
transcriptions.
Yeah,
gigantic. And they were recorded by the biggest bands, Sinatra, Crosby, the biggest celebrities of pop.
Right.
For which they did not get paid, and it was not available to the public. It was only for the armed forces.
Right.
So the Navy got it, the Marine Corps, the Army, et cetera, et cetera. And I used to play them. You know, they played them on the boat when
right.
we would be in safe areas, you know, coming in or just going out, you know. And I would grab the intercom and, who was it? One of the singers, I Walk Alone. That was a big song. For to tell you the truth, I've been lonely. You know? So she would sing, I Walk Alone. For to tell you the truth, and I would cut in, I have B.O. And the guys would all fall down screaming. You know?
You don't have any recordings of anything like that, do you?
No.
You doing that?
No, no.
Well, so
I did wilder stuff like that. That if I told you about it, we'd both be off the air. You'd be out of a job.
I'm sure. A bunch of
I used to do some stuff. I used to make up these phony commercials.
Right.
You know. Real ridiculously obscene commercials, and I'd make them like they were real commercials of those days, like for Coca-Cola or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And the guys would be crying,
right,
you know, laughing
yeah.
their brains out.
So let me ask you, Leo, was that really how you got into show business, was cutting up on a submarine?
Well, actually, when I was a little kid, like from age four on, I didn't exactly entertain, but I used to love to play the harmonica. At age four, I was at a birthday party, and we all got little gifts, and I got this little harmonica, a Marine Band. That was a famous brand, cheap harmonica.
Oh, yes.
And I started playing the harmonica, and everybody started paying a lot of attention. Well, you know, that's the beginning of show business, when you get everybody's attention. And then I was in a park department contest where I played the harmonica, and they start throwing coins at me.
Oh.
And in the time of the Depression, I would pick up 85 cents of coins. That was like I was picking up $50.
Yeah, that was like a month's worth of income.
Well,
right,
I mean,
there.
A little kid, I was like maybe 8 or 9 years old, and I'd be picking up all these coins and going crazy. So from then on, I then went into music and basically was a musician, although self-taught. I never studied. And then the Catskills, you know, which they called the Jewish Alps.
Right, right.
So in the Catskills, I got a little taste of everything. I started working with the comedians and the MCs that were there, and also played in the band. And then that was up to age 18. I joined a big band, and it was then music. It was all music, because I wanted to be a real great arranger and composer.
Do you remember the name of the big band that you joined?
Well, the big band, he wouldn't be that well known today, but he was what is called a big regional band.
Yeah.
That's a band that has a top name in a certain region. In our case, it was Ohio, Pennsylvania, Indiana, and Illinois.
Right, and who was the leader? Do you remember?
Bob Astor, A-S-T-O-R.
All right.
And out of that band, you had Neil Hefti.
Oh.
You had, I can't name it, about three or four blockbuster names.
Well, Neil Hefti's big enough for me.
Yeah. They all came out of that band.
Wow.
And
so anyways,
then after that, I the comedy was something I did within the band to break up the musicians, like during rehearsals or
right.
in between.
Right.
And then in the Catskills, every once in a while, an act would fall out, and I would get out in front of the band and just do little impressions and weird things. And with the band, I would do some of those instrumental sounds vocally. And so here we only had a five-piece band, but with the way we played with my arrangements and with my voice over the microphone blended in, people used to stare. You know, like we had about 8 or 9 pieces, or maybe 10 pieces. But of course, the band sounded so much bigger, but it was only 5 guys.
That's amazing, Leo. So you did the Catskills, you played with the Bob Astor Band for a while. What was your first big break, would you say?
Well, my first very big break was the Arthur Godfrey Talent Scout Show.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I was playing in a joint in Manhattan called the Sawdust Trail. Teresa Brewer came out of there. Josephine, oh, good Lord.
Baker?
Can't think. The young lady that married the guy who wrote Guys and Dolls and everything.
Not Joe Stafford.
No. Joe Sullivan?
Well, you'll think of it later.
Anyway, a lot of people come out of there. And I worked there as a piano player. And I used to accompany the singing waiters.
Uh-huh.
And every once in a while, I had a microphone near me, and I would heckle them, you know, interrupt them, make fun of them, sort of like Spike Jones. They would be doing, bongo, 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 I don't want to leave the Congo, and I'd go, and I'd be doing all kinds of animal sounds in the middle of it. So finally, I was starting to draw a bigger audience than the singing waiters.
Oh, that's
great.
And then
somebody saw me there and says, hey, I'd like to put you on the Godfrey Show. I said, what? I had no idea what I would do, because so much of what I did there was not written down or anything. It was all shooting from the hip, you know, spontaneous. Well, they got me on. I auditioned for the Arthur Godfrey Show, and I did one of the numbers that I used to do at the piano, where I sing Summertime. in about like as a soprano, as a bass, as a tenor, and in between I would sing the actual song "Summertime" and "The Living Is Easy." Fish are jumping, boing, and I do a, you know. So I would start putting sound effects in the middle of this very serious song.
By the way, I love that boing sound.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, that's the most fascinating sound that came out of cartoons, going back to the early days.
Oh, yeah. In fact,
there was a cartoon, Gerald McBoing Boing.
Yes, Gerald McBoing Boing. Well, anyhow, there's a DJ named Howard Stern that uses that sound a lot nowadays. So,
Howard Stern.
Yes, he
calling
uses
him a DJ. That's a laugh.
So, anyhow, you made it onto Arthur Godfrey, which was the biggest big Star Search show of its era, you know.
Right, it definitely was.
Yeah.
And I was on before it was on television, it was radio network, and then the winner of that show, which was myself, I almost collapsed. When I went on because I heard if you go on, you get $100. Holy mackerel, $100, let me at them. You know, that's really, I never dreamed I would win.
Hey, Leo, can I ask you, are there any recordings of that "Summertime"? Do you have any recordings of that?
I actually do.
Oh, my goodness.
No, it's nothing that's been released.
Yeah. No, I'm
talking about I have it on the original Arthur Godfrey, the thing, the show we're talking about.
Right. Oh, man.
That with the audience, and you can hear Arthur Godfrey absolutely falling down over his desk. Because he made it a point not to see the dress rehearsal, so that when he was exposed to the actual show, his reaction would be 100% real.
Right. Oh, that's.
Now, I was thrilled because I was even aware of it while I was doing it. I could hear him howling, you know.
Yeah. So you're on the Arthur Godfrey show. You win.
And if you win, you get. The next 5 days, he was on in the morning, coast to coast. And you'd be on all those five mornings.
Wow.
With his gang, you know, Archie Blyer and the Cordettes and all those people.
Hey, hang on for a second, Leo. I just wanted to tell the audience, you're listening to the Sunday Morning Hangover here on KWVA. We're interviewing Leo D. Lyon, famous voice actor, legend, cartoon star, musician, comedian, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, go ahead, Leo. So do you have any recordings of those Arthur Godfrey morning shows?
Not the morning ones, but I do have the actual competition, the one that I won.
I would love to hear that someday, Leo.
Okay, I'm going to have to.
Oh,
do
man.
You have the wherewithal of playing a cassette? Can you get a
Yes.
I have of it is a audio cassette.
Yes,
I could make a copy of that.
Yes.
Could you change that into whatever format you need?
Yes, what I can do is I can make that into a MP3 and put it on a DVD or a CD. And I can send it back to you on CD, and that way everybody can hear it. If you want to do that, you know.
You know what I would like?
Yeah.
If possible, then you wouldn't have to do this. But I would love a copy of this this broadcast.
Oh, that too. You will get a copy of that as well. I will send you that. So anyway, let's move on a little bit.
Moving right along.
By
the way.
Yes.
And after that, that getting that exposure on the Godfrey show, I was able to get a manager and agency, General Artists Corporation, and then I was being sent out, and I started touring with Peggy Lee. I started touring with, a lot of big Patty Page, Perry Como, for heaven's sake.
Wow.
Who, by the way, is one of the most beautiful guys. You'd ever want to meet in the business.
So was this all pre-World War II that this happened?
Oh, no.
This was after the war.
Oh, yes.
Okay. So
I got out of the service in 1945.
Right.
I was then 20 years old. I went in at 18 and got out at 20. And the Catskills was like 1946 and 7.
Right.
The big band was 46, and 47 was the Catskills. Then 48 was the Sawdust Trail and the joint where I then went on the Godfrey Show.
Right.
And then 49, Leo DeLion hit Broadway.
Ah.
In 49, I went into the Strand Theater with Desi Arnaz and his Review.
Ah, wow.
And that's where Desi Arnaz and I became fairly close. And then a year later, I was part of the show with Desi Arnaz and, hold your breath, Lucille Ball.
Oh, that's amazing. What a
and
story.
She, I want to tell you, I toured with Desi Arnaz on a couple of dates. It was just me and Desi and his band and his Review, and I was part of it. As a comedian, you know, doing crazy bits and so on. Now, in a year later, then, you know, we went our separate ways. I played here and I played there. And a year later, he was touring with Lucille Ball, breaking in the act where she's at the cello with the funny, you know, "Yeah, you from St. Josie?" And that's the act that actually gave them the television show.
Oh, wow. I had no idea.
Because they couldn't picture her working with Desi Arnaz. She says, because she was on the air with my favorite husband.
Right.
Who was Richard Denning.
Right.
An American Caucasian. And blonde and all that kind of stuff. So they said, no, they'll never buy you with you going on television with a Latino husband. She says, but he is my husband. And she insisted. And they said, well, I can't imagine you playing that way with him. And so they put together this act to prove that they could work together, and they were getting screams. Well, they were at the Paramount Theater in San Francisco, and I was added to the show, which was a tremendous compliment to me. It thrilled me out of my mind. And I had never met Lucille Ball before that.
Right.
Now, here I am in the wings, watching Desi Arnaz doing his thing, and I had not met Lucille Ball, although I knew she was there, and I'm waiting, and all of a sudden someone grabs me from behind and turns me over like to give me a big romantic kiss, and there right over me is Lucille Ball saying, "We can't keep meeting like this. They're going to start talking."
Yeah.
And gave me this big hug to say hello and that she heard so much about me from Desi. It was a thrilling moment.
That's wonderful. Hey, did you ever make it any walk-ons on their TV show or anything like that?
I never did get to do
show. Yeah. Well, by this time, though, you were starting to get into some TV, and I have a note here about a show called It's a Business. Now, am I jumping too far ahead, or is this about the time that you got onto that show?
No, It's a Business was about 2 years later.
Right.
Bob Hames was one of the stars, and there was a girl singer. It just kills me. I can't think of her name because...
Dorothy Loudon.
That's the one.
Yeah.
She became a big Broadway star.
Yeah, yeah.
And Mort Lindsay was the music director.
Okay.
Does that name ring a bell?
Yeah, I've heard that name before.
Mort Lindsay was Merv Griffin's conductor.
Oh,
and
yes.
Jolie for years, and then became the conductor for Judy Garland on that famous Carnegie Hall album and concert.
Right, right.
Mort Lindsay.
Now,
actually, Dr. Lindsay, because he got a PhD in music.
if you pardon me, let me back up 1 year because I'm still amazed at that track I played earlier called Mirage, which was basically you multi-tracking your vocals.
In a very primitive manner.
Right.
Because multiple recording today is almost a joke.
Oh, you had to. What you had to do is pull the tape off of the erase head and do sound on sound. Am I correct?
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So
they used to call that ping ponging. You know,
right.
You get two recorders.
Right.
And
you'd bounce
you record
tracks.
On one.
Mm-hmm.
Then you record on the other one, playing the first one into the second one.
Now, Leo,
tell me
how that recording came about. Did you do that at home? Did you buy a tape recorder? Did you go somewhere to do it? How did you
no,
do that?
No, no. I heard so many examples of a form of it. Patty Page, in about 1948 or 49, had a very successful record, With My Eyes Wide Open, I'm Dreaming. And I'm going to try something. Hold on for just a second.
By the way, ladies and gentlemen, we're speaking with Leo D. Lyon, incredibly famous voice actor from the Top Cat TV show, from the Flintstones. I think Leo's going to play something.
Okay, now, here's, see, what Patty Page did was she, With my eyes wide open. See, I'm playing that.
Yeah.
Now, what she did was she imposed three voices under it so it sounded like this. Can you get that? Are you getting that?
Yes, I'm getting it.
Okay, so that was the method that she used, and Sidney Bechet, years later, he was a very famous Dixieland clarinetist.
Yes.
He put together, like, on RCA Victor, I think, I'm not sure, but he put together a whole Dixieland band playing all the instruments that way, very archaic. And then in a Disney film, a big animated Disney thing, Nelson Eddy, the very famous baritone of the early films,
oh, yes,
of the 30s and 40s, and a wonderful baritone singer, he did 100 voices.
Wow.
100 voices for Disney as 100 whales singing. Actually, it was one male, whale. Singing these. Boy, he did all those voices called Monster of the Whale.
Oh, wow.
So I knew about the technique. And then, of course, the famous guitarist.
So where did you record that? Was that done at home or was that done in a
no,
studio?
No, I did that in a studio where a lot of Steve Allen, a lot of famous people went to do some demo records. It was called Associated Records. It was a small private recording studio over a very famous eating cafeteria that all the starving musicians went to, Hector's Cafeteria, right over. Anyway, I went there and I wrote out the arrangement first so that I knew what each track had to do. I also knew that I wouldn't have a metronome and I'd have no way of keeping time. So I had to just pray. So the first track I laid down, I experimented a few times, and I found that if you go too far, the original lines wipe out.
Right.
But in the end, I finally got, I think I set the bass part first so that I would have something to keep the time all the way through.
1951 we're talking about, folks.
That's
this
right.
Way before Bobby McFerrin did all this stuff. So,
that's right.
So,
by the way, he drives me nuts with his talent. He's incredible.
So let's move on a little bit. I'm sure there's like 100 stories you could tell about the people that you worked with in 1951 and 52. You were on TV.
Well, in 51, I did the very, very famous Josephine Baker tour.
Oh.
That was where we toured for 8 months together. In fact, my wife and I, the first house that we ever owned, we used to call it the house that Josephine built.
By the way, was that your wife in the background I heard earlier, or are you still together, or is she still?
Oh, yes.
Oh, wow, Leo.
I'll tell you how together, 67 years together.
Oh, congratulations, Leo. That's an amazing love story, I'll tell you.
I was 20 and she was 18.
She must be very patient.
Wait, excuse me. Wait, my wife just corrected me. What did you say? Up, up, up. She corrected me. We're married 64 years.
Wow. She must
it
be...
only feels like 67.
Yeah.
I got a laugh out of my wife with that. That would be the next comedy line.
She must be a very patient woman. She's very patient, isn't she?
And he just said, she must be a very patient woman. She just said, I am.
Yeah, yeah. So let's get back to 1952, shall we?
Yes.
What was your next project? You did talked about Josephine Baker. You're on TV with It's a Business.
Oh, by the way, with Josephine Baker, we toured with the Buddy Rich Band.
Oh, yeah. I heard he was a fun guy.
Yeah. we got along great, but he was amazing.
Yes, yes. So 1952, we're getting into the early days of TV. Did you do other TV appearances besides It's a Business?
Well, It's a Business was a series.
Right.
And it was live. I mean, mistakes and all. And at the same time, it created some very funny and wonderful scenes. That was the only series I ever was with,
right.
Live series. Anyway.
Right, but you've done...
But I did a lot of guest...
You've done a lot of walk-ins, including up into the 1960s. You appeared on My Mother, the Car. You appeared on Bewitched. You appeared on a number of other programs.
Do research.
Yes, but I have 15 minutes left, and I want to talk more about the recordings. Now,
yes.
I've got a recording here from 1954 on the MGM label that you did a 78 called Say It Isn't So, and the band played on. We heard that earlier.
Right.
Tell me, are there any other records besides that came out on MGM with your name on them?
Nope, that was it.
And how did that one come about?
I think it came about... I did some experiments for Capitol Records, and one of the guys heard an acetate of one of my early experiments at Capitol. I think Say It Isn't So. Pete Rugolo, does that name ring a bell with you?
Oh, yeah. He's all over.
Composer and arranger.
Yes,
Stan Kenton,
yes,
films, everything.
He was on everyone's records through the 50s and 60s, arranged
right.
by Pete Rugolo.
Well,
yeah.
He was one of the guys that helped me through the Capitol tests, you know.
Right, right. So,
and nothing came of those because they didn't know how commercial they could possibly be. And so finally somebody at MGM thought it was worthwhile because he says at least it'll become a conversation piece.
Right, right. Oh, it's a wonderful record. And then the next one after that, the next record is in 1956, correct? For Me and My Gal and
right.
Lonesome
now,
and Disgusting.
Now, that one had some commercial success, but not in this country.
Right.
That sounds funny. It did quite well in Britain.
Right.
Canada and... Australia.
Well, we'll talk about your world tour in a minute, but and I'm sorry for pushing things along, but like I
not
said,
at all. I
we're up against the clock. Lonesome and Disgusted. What is the joke behind that? It's an Al Capp reference.
That was a cartoon that Al Capp, the famous cartoonist, was drawing.
Right.
It was called Long Sam.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
In it, this person, whoever he was, wrote a song that was so horrible that when people heard it, they used to dive out of windows, jump down elevator shafts, you know, and so on. And then one time in one of the panels, they actually printed the music for that song, which was written by...
I've got the record here somewhere if I can find it. Let's see. I'll help you out here, Leo. If I could find the record.
Well, it was a famous...
Irving Vermin. Oh, that's you. Excuse
me. Yeah, but that's a gag.
Yeah. Al Capp, Bob Lubbers, and Dave Lambert.
Dave Lambert.
Yes.
Lambert,
yes.
Hendricks, and Ross.
Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, that's the same Lambert.
That's the Dave Lambert.
Oh, the same guy from the... I played
right.
them on my show, too.
He wrote that song.
Right. So...
And he said, now we got to make a record of it. Well, what the heck kind of a record can you make of this ridiculous song?
I loved it. I played it earlier.
So he immediately was turned on to me,
yeah.
At that record, that recording place, that little Associated Records where everybody made the demos, and then we kind of fooled around with it, and then I came up with the idea of, look, I'll just do it multi-dub like I did the other ones, and we'll just make it something crazy.
Right, right.
So I did an experiment in Red Rodney's house. Does that name ring a bell?
No.
Red Rodney was a very famous bebop trumpet player.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
So let me move along, because...
We did the experiment there, and that's how that turned out.
By the way, Leo, we're talking about Leo DeLion here on the Sunday Morning Hangover interview from live from North Hollywood. By the way, if at some point you hear a doorbell ring, I've got to let the next DJ in. So what I will do is, if that happens, I'm going to put on one of your songs, run down, come back, and resume the interview. So I just wanted to warn you before that happens.
Okay, thanks.
So are there
tell them that I'm not imitating the doorbell.
So are there any other records that you put out between Lonesome and Disgusted and that Jewish Humor album? Did you have anything else going on in, say, 58, 59?
No, except that the English ones that you already had, which amazes me.
Right, right. So I've been playing excerpts from that. And that's the album. You went to England. You recorded a concert. It was pressed. And you sort of got a world tour out of that, so to speak, correct?
Well, that's how I got down to South Africa.
Right, to record the incredible Leo's Here or Like Leo's Here album, and I already told the story of how the title changed on that.
Right.
And I've been playing that record on my show for about 5 years, Leo. And my favorite, of course, is Leo in Africa, but I always love Unchained Melody. And I just wanted, if you could tell the story again of your association with Pat Suzuki and Unchained Melody.
Well, Pat Suzuki and I met when we were doing a stage version of
Flower Drum Song?
No, Over the Rainbow. Where'd that come from?
Wizard of Oz.
Wizard of Oz.
Yes.
We did it in Kansas City. Excuse me.
Which part did you play, Leo?
I was the Tin Woodman.
I figured you'd be the lion.
No, lion. We had a big, heavy guy do it with great makeup.
Right.
You know, and all that stuff. And anyway, Pat Suzuki played Dorothy, and she was unbelievably sensational.
Yes.
And then we remained pretty close friends from then on, and she lived in the Dakota apartment building.
Right.
That's the famous apartment building across the street from Central Park where Lennon...
Right, John lived. Lennon was shot.
Yeah. And, so many celebrities lived in that building.
Yes. And
anyway, I used to do Unchained Melody, which is part of that LP that I made in South Africa.
Right.
And I was appearing with Lena Horne in the Palm Springs, and her husband was Lenny Hayton.
Okay.
Who was a very famous musician and conductor and married to Lena Horne.
Right.
And he took exception to the fact that I did this Unchained Melody during the show, and right in front of me is this big table of Japanese people in the audience. and I told him, I said, after the show, I said to him, you know, I've done this for Pat Suzuki and many of her friends, and whenever she had a party and I was there, she used to beg me to do this, and they would all be rolling around on the floor, laughing. Now, these are Japanese people, so I don't know what your problem is with them.
Yeah, well, it's incredibly funny to me. So, okay, we have the album, Leo's Here comes out, and it comes out in South Africa, and you said you didn't hear anything about it until London called you, right?
Right.
London Records.
Because I didn't even take it seriously. I said, I'm in Johannesburg. Who the heck is going to even give a pig's whistle for this?
Right,
you know?
Right, right.
So I just had myself a good time.
Right.
And that's why Leo in Africa, I was especially puzzled by how they got that, you know, how the London Records got interested in that, because all the references are to the little towns and places around Johannesburg.
Oh, I love it. I played that earlier.
And all the humor is all about those areas. And yet, about 3 or 4 months later, I get this call that they're sending a promotion guy around with me to promote Like Leo's Here.
Oh, man.
And
so, Leo, we haven't even touched on all your great voiceover work, and I'm sorry for moving this forward. I could talk to you for another hour.
Well, that's what happens when you talk to somebody who's 85 years old.
But, Leo, so Leo's Here comes out. What was your next step? How did you get onto the Top Cat TV show?
Well, they had the original, not the original, they auditioned different voices. And Alan Dinehart Jr. was the producer and sometimes associate producer because Joe Barbera took the reins many of the times. And he was such a big fan of mine. He says, Leo, he said, I got to get you into this somehow. So he thought of these two characters. He says, I think this would fit you real well. And I did, I auditioned with Brain and Spook.
Right.
And got the part.
Oh, that must
be. And I was delighted because we worked with Alan Jenkins and
Arnold Stang.
Icon in film.
Yes.
And Arnold Stang, yes. And Marvin Kaplan.
Marvin Kaplan, yes.
And we had great artists, I guess. Herschel Bernardi, Joe Vigran. We had so many people.
Well,
Herb Vigran.
Well, it's so funny that that has turned sort of into your legacy because you appear now on the DVD copies of that. There's extensive interviews with you on the DVD copies.
That's
about
correct.
That. Yeah, and
yeah.
So anybody that wants to see Leo discussing Top Cat should look for the DVD versions with the special stuff on the end of
it. Oh, yeah, the whole set.
Yeah, and we could go on talking about Top Cat forever, but where did you go from there? You appeared on a bunch of other TV shows. Did you do any other cartoons?
I was in Bewitched.
Yes.
I had a one shot on Bewitched. And I did a lot of Jungle Book. Jungle Book. The Disney animation.
That's right. You appeared in Jungle Book.
Yeah.
And what character
was that?
No, I didn't
appear, but my voice, that King Louie scene.
Yes.
You know, that was done by Louis Prima.
Yes.
Well, there's a bunch of little monkeys that are jumping all around him.
Right.
During that scene.
Right.
And the music is going, boom, chick, boom, chick, boom, chick, boom, chick. And he's singing, I'm the king of the jungle. Boom. And then in the meantime, in the background, you have these little monkeys like a little jam session thing. I did all those monkeys.
Oh, that's amazing. You know, we skated by all your associations with Steve Allen, Milton Berle, those people.
Phil
and we
Silvers.
Could talk Jack Benny, Phil Silvers. You appeared on a number of those different programs. But like I said, we're running out of time. I want to talk now about your association with Sandler and Young. That was you worked with Sandler and Young for so long, it seems.
I worked with them for 7 years, but I knew Ralph Young. I knew him from 1949 on.
Right.
When I was a comedian in these big reviews in Manhattan, and he was the production singer. You know, like, there she goes, Miss America, you know, that kind of stuff.
Right.
And then he started to break out a little bit on his own, and I wrote some of his arrangements. But we remained friendly through the years.
Right.
And
so now we're all the way into the 1970s, which is still 40 years ago.
Yeah, I joined them. They created their act around the mid-60s.
Right.
I was with Phil Silvers at the time, and I wrote their 10 first arrangements.
Uh-huh.
But I was with Phil Silvers, so I couldn't be with them.
Right.
And they had no conductor of their own.
Right.
But I did everything for a small group because at that time they were just beginning, and all they could work with was a small group in the Vegas Lounge, right. Lake Tahoe Lounge,
now, Reno Lounge. Now, Leo, I see their records around. Are you on any of their record albums?
Well, I was on the last, I was on six albums of theirs.
Oh, I've got to find those now.
But I don't know where the heck you can get them.
Oh, well, you know, you see them in the cutout bins.
Because they used to sell them separately. Well, wait a minute. They did do several very big albums.
Yeah.
With Capitol.
Right, right. They were on Capitol.
But I was not part of those.
Right. But you, so we're in.
In fact, the Capitol ones is what really broke them through.
So we're in the 1970s now. You finished with Sandler and Young. What did you do after that?
After that, I tried to get into film composing.
Right.
Because by that time, when I was working with Sandler and Young, I was deeply steeped in music, which was my, believe it or not, my first love.
Mm-hmm.
That was my real passion. And I really, I wasn't that good a piano player. I was adequate. I was okay. But I was a pretty darn good arranger and orchestrator. And that's where I really blossomed with Sandler and Young. And I conducted and arranged a couple of TV specials that they did. And I was extremely proud of that because that took a lot of derring do, and I had never done it before. And I remember when we did the Christmas special in Canada for Buick, and then it was all through, and we were coming out of the elevator, and the advertising heads and everybody came over, and the producer says, well, these are the guys that sponsored the show. And they were congratulating me. Oh, boy, the music was great. He says, what other television specials have you conducted and arranged for? And I said to them, after swallowing, I said, this was my first. And they almost had a heart attack. But it was very successful.
So now we're getting into the 70s, into the 80s.
Then after that, I tried to get into film composing. But by the time I came out here, the big musicians' union strike hit, and the floor fell out.
Ah.
And I didn't have a prayer.
Well, I saw something on the net now that you were, it was back in the 90s. You were doing, signing autographs at a bunch of conventions. Do you still do that?
What do you call those?
They're kind of like fan conventions, and they have them where...
There's a name for it.
They have a bunch of stars come out.
Anyway, I've been to those a few times.
Yes.
And I was amazed. I think, who the heck would want to have, an autograph of a guy doing a voice?
Oh, I would.
And I was amazed at how many did line up.
Yeah, there's a guy... In fact, I was watching a video of you on the net the other day of you talking. It's an interview at one of the conventions. It's out on the internet. Yeah, I should send you that link, too.
You know, with this day and age of computers and internet and all that stuff, you really have to watch what you're doing at all times.
Oh, tell me about it. Hey, everything I do gets archived and put on the air. So tell me, Leo, what are you doing nowadays? Well, obviously, you're retired. Oh, by the way, what's your wife's name?
Ann.
Okay, big shout out to Ann. We're talking to Leo D. Lyon, and we're going to be kind of wrapping this up in a few minutes. What do you do with yourself nowadays? What is your big thing that you like to do?
Well, let me see. For one thing, I'm transferring a lot of my stuff on tape, audio cassettes particularly, especially original compositions and stuff. I'm putting them onto CDs. And in not too long from now, the CDs will be out of fashion.
Right,
as well.
Right. You know it.
And but after that, I will be aware of anything.
You mentioned you were playing at some homes down in the Reseda area. You were working with...
No. Those are old age. It's the Reseda... let me see. What is it called?
Reseda Alzheimer's Center?
The Reseda... The Reseda Jewish Home for the Aging.
Yes, and you're working with the drummer for Spike Jones.
Yeah, he was Joe Siracusa.
That must be...
He was with Spike Jones for years and then became a very important and successful film editor. He used to do a lot of the cartoons that won awards and everything like that.
Right.
But he's 3 years older than I am.
Yeah.
And he has the energy of Mighty Mouse. I'm telling you, he's amazing. But he still plays drums. And the two of us, we just clown around and sing for the people. And when we come in, boy, forget about it.
So
we do that once a month.
The way I was able to track you down, Leo, was there's a gentleman named Dan Duderino. Do you know who that is?
That's my son.
Yes, Dandy Deuterino set up a Leo D. Lion page on Facebook.
I found out about that by remote control. A lot of people started calling me. I had no idea.
And it's a wonderful page because everybody, if you go to Facebook and type in Leo D. Lion, you'll find a lot of MP3s and a lot of recordings that you heard on this show, the Sunday Morning Hangover with Leo D. Lion. And it's a great setup. And I've been posting on that page. And if you go back, I know you're not on the net, Leo. A lot of people your age aren't. But if you went back and looked at my shows, you see I've been playing you for years and years. And you know, I'm running out of time here. I wanted to play one more track for to kind of do a transition with the next DJ. But Leo, we got to do this again sometime because we haven't touched half of some of the stories.
It would be my pleasure.
And I wanted to thank you so much from the bottom of my heart for taking the time out and appearing here on this radio show. You will get a copy of it. Leo D. Lion, everybody. Like I said, we didn't get to half the stories that Leo has, and I hope we could do it again sometime. So,
okay, meanwhile, I'm gonna send out a quick shout-out
yes. For
you and everybody else to check up on Lewis Landon. He's my oldest son, and he's into a lot of piano stuff.
All right. Well, thank you. Leo D. Lion, this is KWVA Eugene. Leo, hang on. I want to talk to you off the air for a second.
Right on.
Thank you, Leo.
Another bride, another June, another sunny honeymoon, another season, another reason for making whoopee. A lot of shoes, a lot of rice. The groom is nervous, he answers twice. It's really killing that he's so willing to make will be a picture, a little love nest, way down where the roses cling. Picture the same sweet love nest, think what a year can bring. He's washing dishes and baby clothes. He's so ambitious, he even sews. But don't forget, folks, that's what you get, folks, for making whoopee. I hear, well, can't you guess? She feels neglected, and he's suspected of making whoopee. She sits alone most every night. He doesn't phone her or even write. He says he's busy, but she says, is he? He's making whoopee. And he doesn't make much money, only 5,000 per. Some judge who thinks he's funny says you'll pay six to her. He says, now, judge, suppose I fail. The judge says,
but right in the jail.
You'd better keep her. You'll find it's cheaper than me.